This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Monday is a national holiday honoring Martin Luther King. The civil rights movement of the 60s is the subject of this archive edition of Fresh Air. James Farmer was one of the architects of the movement. Farmer co-founded CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality, which was one of the first civil rights groups to apply Gandhi's principles of nonviolent resistance. Farmer's nonviolent demonstrations were answered with attacks by white mobs and mass arrests of CORE members during the Freedom Rides in the early 60s. CORE's interracial groups of freedom riders rode buses through the southern states to see to it that the Supreme Court's decision banning segregation in bus terminals was actually being enforced. The resulting drama focused national attention on the violence of southern racism. I spoke with James Farmer in 1985, and he told me that his mother believed that Farmer's father tried to time his death to coincide with the most dangerous part of the Freedom Rides.
Yes. Before the Freedom Riders left Washington, this was on May 4th of 1961, I went to visit my father, who was a terminal patient of cancer in Washington, D.C. hospital. Told him what we were going to do, how we were going to do it, and where we were going through Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, through Mississippi, and hopefully arriving in New Orleans. He, being a Southerner himself and a scholar, thought for a while and says, well, I think you'll be all right in Virginia and the Carolinas, maybe even Georgia, but not in Alabama. They'll take a pot shot at you there. I don't think you'll reach Mississippi. If you should reach Mississippi, then you will think that Alabama was purgatory and Mississippi is hell. But you certainly won't reach New Orleans. He said, I wish you wouldn't go, but I know you will. Now, after I left, I had left my father a copy of the itinerary, of course. My mother says that each day he would pick up my itinerary and look at it. And to see where I was, oh, he's in North Carolina, that's all right. But when he picked up the piece of paper with my schedule on it and saw, uh-oh, he's just about to go through Alabama, then he just let go and died. She believed that he had been holding on to the tenuous thread of life until this time so that his death could bring me back before going through Alabama. She believed that until her death 5 years later. I don't know whether that's possible or not, but it apparently worked.
Alabama was one of the most violent stops.
Yes.
Do you ever look back on that and wonder if you would have survived had you been on the bus when it went through Alabama?
Yes, of course. I'm quite confident that I would have been killed, that I would have died. You see, I had scheduled myself to lead the testing in the waiting rooms in the bus terminals in Alabama, because this was going to be the critical one. I was going to lead the testing. I was going to enter first the white waiting room at all of the stops in Alabama. I was going to make the decisions that had to be made on the spot there. But when I was called back to Washington to bury my father just hours before the bus left Atlanta to go through Alabama, I left a Jim Peck, this then-young white freedom rider, in charge of the testing. He was almost killed in Birmingham, and I feel quite certain that I would have been killed. But then Montgomery, I didn't want to go, because after what had happened in Alabama, I thought going into Mississippi would be worse. You know, Mississippi at that time had the reputation of being the ultra, the apex of racism. And I thought that what had happened in Alabama then would be only a prelude to what awaited us in Mississippi. Yet the young freedom riders, SNCC young people, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, from Nashville, young CORE people from New Orleans had joined forces in Montgomery to take the ride into Jackson. And I was there, and they presumed I was going with them since it was my show. Nobody asked me if I was going. They just assumed it. But I had other thoughts because, my father had just died, and two deaths in the family in a week would be a bit much for my mother and for the family. Furthermore, I'd been away from my office for 6 weeks, and mail had piled high, and people needed answers to their letters, and CORE had to raise money to keep its activities going, including the Freedom Ride, and I was needed to help in that process. Oh, I'd cataloged all of these excuses in my mind, but the bottom line was that I was scared to death. And that's the reason I didn't want to go. And I was determined not to go, because I wanted to live. I did not want to die then. I went down that morning that the young Freedom Riders were going to board their buses for the journey from Montgomery, Alabama, to Jackson, Mississippi. I went down really to say goodbye to them and wish them Godspeed. I remember reaching through the open window of a bus to shake hands with a 17-year-old CORE girl from New Orleans, Doris Castle. I said, "Well, Doris, have a safe journey, and after the Freedom Rides, we'll get together and we'll discuss the next step." She looked at me in disbelief. She said, "But Jim, you're going with us, aren't you?" And I said, "Oh, well, no, Doris, you see." And then I went through the whole litany of excuses which I had prearranged in my mind. She shook her head and said, "Jim, please." Well, that was too much. I had to go then.
Well, you encountered quite a lot of trouble on that ride. You were all arrested. What grounds were you arrested on?
There were three charges: disobeying an officer, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot. We were arrested by Captain Ray, who was the chief of police of the city of Jackson, when he ordered me to move on. And I asked where. The young lady with me, who had locked arms with me, she and I were about to go into the restaurant there in the waiting room, the white waiting room, for dinner. And other Freedom Riders followed the two of us, and were similarly told to get into the paddy wagon. And we were taken to jail. Then I sent orders by my lawyer to my CORE staff in New York to begin immediately recruiting Freedom Riders, white and black, from all over the country, sending them into Jackson to try, in true Gandhian fashion, to fill up the jails. We were not going to bail out. We were going to stay in as long as we could stay in and still file an appeal, and that turned out to be 40 days and 40 nights.
Did the jails want you out?
Yes. They quickly found out that we were not going to bail out right away, and then what they wanted to do was to make it so uncomfortable for us that we'd wish we had never come, and we'd stop others from coming. They did not physically beat us, though they tried once at one place, and that backfired because I got one young man bailed out, and he called the FBI, and he also held a press conference, so that stopped the physical brutality. But they did such things as putting so much salt in the food that we couldn't eat it. Many of us were chain smokers, and we were denied any cigarettes, but the guards would walk by our cells puffing on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into our cells at great length. We were students or readers. They denied us any newspapers or any books, refused to let any come in, refused to let us have any paper or any pencils to do any writing whatsoever. We were denied any visitors except our lawyer. This was psychological brutality.
You were also banned from singing at one point.
Well, they tried to stop us from singing. We sang. We sang all the freedom songs we knew, and we made up new ones. I made up one song, wrote one song. Actually, it was I put new words to an old labor song, "Which Side Are You On?"
What were the words you wrote?
Well, these words, I can't sing, so I won't even try to sing it. Said, "Come all you freedom fighters, good news to you I'll tell of how the good old Freedom Ride has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 They say in Hinds County, where Jackson was, Jackson, Mississippi, no neutrals have they met. You're either for the Freedom Ride or you're Tom for Ross Barnett. He was the governor of Mississippi. My father was a freedom fighter, and I'm a freedom fighter's son. And I'll stick to the Freedom Ride till every battle's won. Well, the jailers went wild at our singing because we were singing as loudly as we could and our voices were wafting out over the city of Jackson. And the windows were open. They would come in and slam our windows shut and we would open them again and sing more and more and more. Other Freedom Riders, the black women in another wing, the white men in another wing, the white women in another wing would pick up the song, and so the jailhouse was rocking with freedom song. The jailers are running around saying, "Stop that singing! Stop that singing! Stop it!" And we continued singing because it was good for our morale. It was good for our morale, and if there were any fear left in us, that fear was dissipated by the song.
What did they do to try to prevent you from singing after closing the window and yelling at you didn't work?
Well, in Parchman, the state penitentiary, said, "If you don't stop that singing, we'll take away your mattresses." Well, now that sounds like a juvenile threat, but it was an important threat because the little thin straw mattress was the only comfort we had. Everything else was cold, hard stone and steel in those tiny little cells. But there was this little mattress, which was comfort, which was a symbol of home, symbol of domesticity. And now they're going to take that away. We'd have nothing else. Well, that caused some people to stop singing for a while until one young man who was a Bible student reminded everybody what they were doing. Said, here they're trying to take your soul away, you see. It's not the mattress, it's your soul. And then one Freedom Rider yelled, "Guards! Guards! Guards!" And the deputy came running out into the cell block to see what was wrong. And this Freedom Rider shouted, "Come get my mattress. I'll keep my soul." And then song exploded again. We began singing. Then another time, I have to laugh when I think of this. One Freedom Rider was complaining that this deputy, who was in charge of the guards, always called us boy, you boys. He said, why does he always call us boy? We are men. I think we ought to refuse to answer until he calls us men. Another one reminded him that that was just a custom down south, and he didn't mean anything derogatory by it. So this fellow said, first fellow said, "I think I'll ask him." He called Deputy Tyson. Said, "Deputy Tyson, what?" Says, "Do you mean anything derogatory when you call us boy?" Deputy Tyson said, "I don't know nothing about no rogatory. All I know is if you boys don't stop that singing, you're going to be singing in the rain." And then somebody started singing again. They pulled in a high-pressure fire hose and washed us all down with it. We tumbled over and everything was floating in the water in our cells. One of the Freedom Riders then yelled, "Deputy Tyson, next time you're going to do that, bring us some soap so we can take a shower."
I'm speaking with James Farmer, civil rights activist, co-founder of CORE. In your memoir, you say that civil rights generalship was one quarter leadership, one quarter showmanship, one quarter upsmanship, and one quarter partnership. Did you ever get disillusioned with the upsmanship and the showmanship part and the competition that happened between some of the civil rights leaders and civil rights groups?
Well, not disillusioned, but I came to understand it. We were dealing with human beings. All of us were human beings. And we had our frailties and we had our individual jealousies. And there was competition between them. Now, the organizations got their money chiefly from the same sources, from liberal white contributors. And the contributors had only a certain amount of money to give. And that was the reason the organizations competed for public relations, for the media, for headlines, because of that competition for money. And it's the reason, one reason, there was so much jealousy between the organizational heads. Another reason is that everybody who was number two or number three or number four would like to be number one. King was number one because he was the most prestigious, the most prominent, the best known, the best covered by the media, so that there was considerable envy of Martin Luther King.
Do you think he deserved that position?
Deserved it? Yes, he deserved it, in the sense that when the Montgomery bus boycott began after Rosa Parks was arrested for sitting on the front of a city bus in Montgomery, Dr. King had the right ingredients, the right elements, the right talents for that right period in history. He was a Southern, an eloquent Southern Baptist minister, Southern accent, a great preacher, a great orator. And so people immediately were drawn in. So he was perfect for that time. In that sense, Dr. King deserved it. He was not a perfect man. He had his frailties like everyone else. You know, I tell a story in my autobiography, Lay Bare the Heart, now when he invited the Freedom Riders to have dinner with him when we reached Atlanta. He didn't even pick up the tab. You know, he invited all 14 of us.
And took you to a very expensive restaurant.
Took us to an expensive restaurant. I waited and waited after we had finished eating, had coffee, more coffee and more coffee, and I was sure he was going to pick it up. Nothing happened. So I said, well, if I start trying to pick it up but move very slowly, then he'll beat me to the punch. But I moved slowly, and I got the bill, and I had to pay it. Well, so he was frail, as all of us are, and he had his weaknesses. But his contribution was enormous. Yes, he deserved it.
James Farmer, recorded in 1985. He's living in Virginia now, where he teaches civil rights history at Mary Washington College. Farmer is now completely blind. His 1985 memoir is called Lay Bare the Heart. We'll hear about the Freedom Singers after this break. This is Fresh Air. James Farmer's story about singing in prison gives you some idea of how important freedom songs were in the civil rights movement. Bernice Johnson Reagan has sung freedom songs at civil rights marches and sit-ins, at rallies and in prison. She was a founding member of the Freedom Singers, who were affiliated with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She later founded the a cappella group Sweet Honey and the Rock, which sings freedom songs, spirituals, and new songs that add to those traditions. I spoke to her in 1988. She told me that the Freedom Singers were organized after SNCC leaders and Pete Seeger decided that a group of traveling singers would help build support for those parts of the movement that didn't get on the news, like small demonstrations and efforts in rural communities.
SNCC was at that point trying to go into what they call Black Belt areas. These are areas in the South where Black people outnumbered whites, usually 3-1. And if we could break into voter registration in those areas, it would really turn around political power. But knocking on doors and getting people to register to vote is not the same as getting 700 people arrested. And press was very difficult to get. So the Freedom Singers came out of a need to have another kind of structure to generate support about that kind of organizing activity.
We call the songs that you sang freedom songs, but some of them were spiritual, some of them were old slave songs too, weren't they?
I mean, how the freedom songs came out of the repertoire first, the standard repertoire of what you were singing, so that you would have a song like Paul and Silas bound in jail, had no money for to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize, hold on. That's a spiritual. But that song just moves straight into civil rights movement activity, and you can understand it. If you're in the Black church, you learn about Paul and Silas being locked up in jail. They were really radical SNCC workers. They are the first Christian organizers into Europe. And they go into this town, and they're preaching, and they throw them in jail. They start to sing and pray. And as a result, the jail let them out. Well, even though they preach about this in the Black church, if you grew up in a Black family, the best badge you can have is that you never got into trouble with the law. So at the same time you're preaching about these radical Christians organizing going forth, you're trying to really stay cool within your society. When you're in the civil rights movement, that's the first time you establish yourself in a relationship that's pretty close to the same relationship that used to get the Christians thrown in the lion's den. And so for the first time, those old songs, you understand in a way that nobody could ever teach you. So that songs like Hold On, Eyes on the Prize, Hold On, Old Freedom, This Little Light of Mine, We Shall Not Be Moved, We Shall Overcome, all of those songs were church songs. But they got new meaning as a part of the civil rights movement. Added to that were new songs that people created.
Was there a time when you were with the Freedom Singers, an example of a time where you sang a certain song and it really kind of changed the mood or brought the mood to the next level?
The singing with the Freedom Singers is different in a way than singing in the movement on the scene. By the time we formed the Freedom Singers, we were transporting a microcosm experience. So we would be these four people standing in this hall singing and talking about the movement. But many times in the movement, one of the strongest things was a song called This May Be the Last Time. It's a song that is a powerful mood setter. You can't really sing the song without thinking about the statement you're making. And it says, this may be the last time, maybe the last time, I don't know. Maybe the last time we all sing together. Maybe the last time we all pray together. Many times, that song would be done just before a march. And it would make you know something of the potential cost that you were going into and taking the stand you were taking.
Bernice Johnson Reagan recorded in 1988. Reagan directs the Smithsonian's program in Black American culture. She has a new NPR series on African American sacred music traditions called Wade in the Water. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.